Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lin, Susan Shand, and Anne Ball. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lin.
A report says the number of robots being used in workplaces across the United States doubled from 2009 to 2017. Most of the robots worked in manufacturing operations across America's Midwest, the report said. It noted that the effect robots had on manufacturing job losses was lessened by economic growth that followed the last major U.S. recession. The report comes from the Century Foundation Research Group, which is based in New York City. William M. Rogers III is a professor of public policy and chief economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University in New Jersey. He co-wrote the report. It examines how workplace robots are affecting U.S. workers and their pay. A growing economy independent of technology, independent of robotics, has been able to absorb, at least at the national level, people who may have gotten displaced, Rogers told VOA. Some Midwest states have twice as many robots as all other U.S. areas and have suffered from the rise in robot workers, the report found. Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin have the highest levels of working robots, mostly in manufacturing businesses. Industrial robots generally perform jobs that do not change much from day to day. These include putting things together, loading products, welding, or painting. The report found that the workers most affected by the machine takeover are young people. They also had less education than other workers. Black men and women experienced the greatest job losses. Rogers noted that U.S. workers who change jobs and find themselves unemployed in different industries often have to settle for lower pay. This can also be a problem when large job displacements lead to an oversupply of workers in some industries. If demand for workers is not growing fast enough, you begin to see a decline in wages, he added. Rogers called on employers to develop better ways to help the displaced workers. If the right solutions are found, he said, some workers pushed out by robots can actually end up getting higher paid positions. Assistance programs should include education and training programs to help prepare people for new career paths. Rogers added that now is the best time to prepare for the rise of the robots. What better time to be able to help people who are getting bullied, so to speak, by technology? Or getting bullied, so to speak, by globalization, he said. Times of prosperity is the best time to invest in all Americans. I'm Brian Lin.
The Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris celebrated Christmas every year during two world wars. But it will not hold a Christmas Catholic Mass in 2019. An accidental fire on April 15th has quieted the 855-year-old cathedral. Officials have moved its famous altar and other objects to another church in Paris called Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois. It was once a royal church where French kings worshipped. It is not far from Notre Dame and just next to the Louvre. Church officials are asking those devoted to Notre Dame to come there on Christmas as rebuilding efforts continue. A cathedral rector, Patrick Chauvet, said this year marks the first time since the French Revolution that there will be no midnight mass at Notre Dame. The French Revolution began in 1789 and continued until 1799. There was even a Christmas service during the fighting of World War I, Chauvet noted. During World War II, Paris was under Nazi occupation, but there was no problem, he said. Chauvet added that, to his knowledge, the cathedral only closed for Christmas for a few years after 1789. At that time, anti-Catholic French revolutionaries turned the church into a house of reason, he said. Christmas Mass at Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois this year will be historic. We will celebrate the Mass outside the walls, so to speak, but with some indicators that Notre Dame is connected to us, Chauvet said. Those indicators include a wooden altar that has been built in the Saint-Germain Church to appear similar to Notre Dame's altar. Members of the Notre Dame choir will sing. The cathedral's famous Virgin of Paradise sculpture will also be there. The 14th century masterpiece shows Mary and her baby Jesus. It was not damaged in the fire. Chauvet remembers when he discovered the Virgin of Paris had survived the fire. He was holding hands with French President Emmanuel Macron in front of the cathedral at the time. Later, they were able to look inside. Chauvet pointed and cried to Macron, "Look at the Virgin. She is there." He said later that Notre Dame's workmen on the ground asked him not to take the statue from the cathedral. They told him that she has protected them during the repair efforts. Chauvet said having it close for Christmas is comforting. She lived very much in Notre Dame. She watched all the 35,000 visitors a day. It keeps us going, Chauvet said. I'm Susan Shand.
Reyes Gauna, a son of Mexican immigrants, proves the saying, where there's a will, there's a way. In other words, if you want something badly enough and work hard enough, you can make it happen. In Gauna's case, he went from cleaning classrooms to leading a California school system. That is, from being a custodian to superintendent. In the middle, He earned a high-level university education and achieved a doctorate. Now, he is in his first year, leading the Byron Union School District in Northern California. How did Gauna do it?
Divine intervention at every level. I always remember when I wanted to give up, someone would put their hand on my shoulder and say, look, kid, you have potential. Don't give up.
Divine intervention means that Gauna believes that God, or someone God directed, helped him stay focused on his goals. One was the custodian at his school when he was a boy. He called her Nike because she wore Nike shoes. Gauna wanted those kinds of shoes too, but his parents could not afford them. Young Gauna liked how Nike made everything so clean. He told her he wanted to be a custodian too.
She goes, well, it's good if you want to be a custodian, but make sure that you go to college and make this as one of your steps there.
Gauna also looked up to the principal, the leader at his school. He was a tall, friendly, and good-looking man who wore nice clothes. He told Gauna about his job helping students and teachers.
I said, wow, when I grow up, I want to do what you're doing. And he says, well, if you don't give up, you'll get there.
Gauna did get there, and the two men remain friends. His former principal is now almost 90 years old. But before Gauna became a school principal, he followed in Nike's footsteps and became a custodian. He worked for three schools in Lodi, California. His work cleaning the schools earned the money he needed to pay for the first 2 years of college. Then he worked as a campus safety officer, teacher, counselor, administrator, and now superintendent. It was a long distance to travel for a boy who grew up without much money and seven brothers and sisters. Gauna says he was a very shy child who was very quiet in school. He did not like wearing used clothes and inexpensive shoes. But his parents struggled to pay for basic expenses. They always had two jobs to make ends meet. On the weekends, the whole family went to the fields to work. When the children were young, they stayed in the car. As they got bigger, they worked too. Gauna says his parents wanted their children, who were born in the U.S., to give back to their country. They also wanted their children to stay in school. His mother ended her education when she was around 8, and his father, 13. Now Gauna tells his own three children how important an education is for their lives. The superintendent says that even though he has had a successful career, he never forgets where he came from or how he felt. He uses his life experiences to guide him as a leader. For example, Gauna's younger sister needs a wheelchair to get around. To this day, her disability helps him as a school administrator.
You know, I learned about advocacy for special ed children as a sibling, because my sister was born after me, and I remember crying all the time because people would make fun of her.
From a young age, Gauna was a translator for his parents, whose native language was Spanish. Helping them made Gauna understand the need for adults to learn English. And so, for many years, Gauna taught English classes for adults in the community. In addition, as a child, he suffered from bullying. Other students were unkind to him. This experience makes him watch out for the quiet children. And being a cleaner at a school made him think about how to show respect for everyone in an organization.
When I was a custodian, you were like a ghost. No one really saw you. Yeah, the principals talked to you and they said hi to you, but nobody else cared about you.
In Gauna's school system today, everyone is invited to parties and events. Everyone is important, from the people who clean the floors, drive the buses, teach the students, lead the schools, and direct the entire operation. I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the years just after the Civil War, America was led by Andrew Johnson. The Democrat rose from vice president to president when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in April of 1865. Andrew Johnson soon found himself in a bitter struggle with Congress. In 1868, radical members of the Republican Party held a trial in the Senate. They tried to remove the president from office. But they could not prove their charges, and their effort failed by one vote. When the trial was over, Johnson had less than a year left in office. He retired to his home in Tennessee. By then, Americans had elected a new president. Larry West and Shep O'Neill tell the story of the election of 1868.
There was no question about the Republican choice for president. Party leaders wanted General Ulysses Grant. Grant had been head of the Union Army during the last part of the Civil War. Under his leadership, the Union had won, and now he was the best-liked man in the country. Wherever Grant went, former soldiers waited to shake the hand of the man who had led them to victory against the Confederacy. The Democratic Party had a much more difficult time choosing a candidate for president in 1868. 47 men wanted the nomination. After several votes during its convention, the party failed to choose one above the others. Finally, party leaders looked for a compromise candidate. They chose Horatio Seymour, a former governor of New York State. He won the nomination on the 22nd ballot. Seymour, at first, said he could not accept the honor. He said he did not want to be president. But finally, after much urging from other party leaders, he agreed to run against Grant.
The presidential campaign was a strange one. Neither Grant nor Seymour campaigned very hard. Grant told his advisors he would take no part in the election campaign. Seymour spent much of the time working on his farm. The real campaigning was done by party supporters. Republicans urged Union men to vote as you shot for Ulysses Grant, the man who won the Civil War. They warned that Horatio Seymour and the Democrats were all secret rebels in their hearts. Seymour's supporters spent most of their time answering Republican charges. They struck back by accusing Grant of being a liar. They said he was controlled by extremists. They said he would rule from the White House like a dictator.
The Democratic attacks failed. Grant got more popular votes and electoral votes than Seymour. He won the election. It was a great victory for the military hero. Yet it also was the start of an administration that would suffer many problems. Ulysses Grant would prove to be much less successful in politics than in war. As Andrew Johnson prepared to leave the White House a few months after Grant's election, he would look back on some successes during his time as president. True, he had lost the political fight to control the rebuilding or reconstruction of the defeated Southern states, but he had won the equally important fight to keep the presidency independent from Congress. Johnson also could look back on some successes in foreign relations. During his administration, he got Napoleon III of France to withdraw French forces from Mexico, and he got more territory for the United States.
In the spring of 1867, the Russian minister in Washington made a surprise offer. He said his country was willing to sell some of its territory in North America. Secretary of State William Seward quickly prepared a treaty accepting the offer. Russia wanted $10 million for the land. Seward said the United States would pay only $7 million. Russia accepted, and the treaty was signed. The United States flag was raised over Alaska. Many Americans protested the purchase of Alaska. They thought $7 million was too much to pay for a worthless piece of frozen land. They said the deal was foolish. They called it Seward's folly. In time, of course, these critics were proved wrong. Alaska's wealth in oil, natural gas, trees, fish, and animal skins makes its purchase one of the greatest deals any country ever made for territory.
On March 4th, 1869, Ulysses Grant traveled to Washington for his inauguration as the 18th President of the United States. Outgoing President Andrew Johnson refused to take part in the ceremony. Before Grant arrived, Johnson left the White House. As he walked out, he told a friend, "I think I can already smell the fresh mountain air of my home in Tennessee." Americans had high hopes for their new president. They saw Grant as a strong and silent soldier, a great leader who had won a long and bitter war. But there was another side to Grant which most people did not see. During the Civil War, the general had been a great hero. For many years before that, however, he had been considered a failure.
As a young man, Grant entered West Point, the nation's school for Army officers. He did poorly in his studies. He did not like responsibility. Somehow, he completed his studies and became an Army officer. He fought in America's war against Mexico. After the war, Grant got into trouble. He drank too much whiskey, too often. The Army forced him to resign. For the next 8 years, he tried one thing after another. He failed at each one. He tried farming, for example, and failed. He tried selling land, and failed at that, too. At last, Grant appealed to his father for a job in a store. He held this low-paying job until the Civil War started. Then he finally got back into the Army. He got his chance to succeed.
Still, the years of poverty and failure affected Ulysses Grant. They made him lack trust in his own judgment and abilities. This feeling showed itself when Grant reached the White House. The new president had little knowledge of politics or government, and he refused to ask for advice from experts. To do so, he felt, would show a lack of intelligence. For advice, he depended on close friends. These were the men with whom he had served during the Civil War. Grant had never been able to make much money. He liked and had great respect for men who had. He became friends with some of these wealthy men. He accepted gifts from them. This weakness for money and power became clear when he announced his choices for his cabinet.
Grant named a rich businessman to be Treasury Secretary. The Senate rejected him. Grant named another rich businessman for Navy Secretary. This nomination was approved, even though the man had never been on a ship. Grant named several other rich people and old military friends to the cabinet. Many lacked political experience. Some critics attacked the appointments. One critic said, "Never was an administration begun with more hope and less ability."
The best advisor Grant named was John Rawlins as Secretary of War. Rawlins was a good judge of men, and he was wiser than most of Grant's other friends. He alone, of all those around the president, would argue with Grant when he believed him to be wrong. Rawlins, however, was in poor health. His condition grew worse during the summer of 1869. Early in autumn, he died. Rawlins' death hurt President Grant deeply. But the lack of honest, wise advice in the White House would hurt the country even more. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.